thank you very much for the opportunity to talk here. I will talk about OPE for scattering amplitude. This is the work that was done with Aldai, Gaiotto, Maldacena, and Pedro Vieira. And I'll try to keep things as simple as possible. I will just follow the simplest example, talk in detail, and then from it, we'll try to infer what is the general structure. And probably next week, Juan or Pedro will talk more about the OPE.
Or both.
Or both. So the object we will study are this polygon Wilson loops that I don't have to advertise for these lotus, that they are equal to the also to the scattering amplitudes, where the edges of the polygons are the momenta of the scattered gluons, and so on. And following Simon talk, by now we understand this duality already for MHV and also non-MHV amplitudes. The expansion that I will describe for this object, for this Wilson loop, is a very general expansion. It applies almost for any conformal gauge theory. It does not rely on the planar limit or on weak coupling in any way. It's any coupling and also non-planar. The main tool is the conformal invariance. Of course, we all know that actually the expectation values of such a Wilson loop suffer from UV divergences. So the observable that I will focus on is the expectation value of this Wilson loop after we took off the well-understood UV divergences. That is, the object I will talk, let's call it R, will be, let's say, the reminder function. This is if the amplitude is MHV, or the ratio function if we talk about non-MHV. Or alternatively, some ratio of Wilson loops, such that these divergences cancel out, and this quantity we will call small r. What's common to all these quantities is that they are conformally invariant. Therefore, only a function of the conformal cost ratios. These conformal cost ratios, let's write chi I j k l, are made of the dislocations of the cusps. So this will be x1, this will be x2, and so on. So they take the form of xi j squared x k l squared over xi k squared x j l squared. What we will do, we'll take a limit where some subset of adjacent edges of this polygon become collinear. Let's say this set down here, we will take a limit where all of these approach this line, just squash it. In that limit, any cross ratios that involve, let's say, 2 points along this set of edges will go to zero. So some cross ratios will scale, it's what we call e to the minus tau, that will go to zero in this limit. And what we will do, we'll have a power expansion in this parameter. This is like when we take the usual collinear limit, we have the leading singularity. What we will keep is all the power expansion as we approach the collinear limit. But once you know all this power expansion, you can resum it and get the full amplitude, or the full Wilson loop in that case. Before discussing this Wilson loop, let me do an analogy. Let me remind you how we compute correlation function of local operators in a conformal field theory. So suppose we want to compute the correlation function of some four local operators. And we want to use the operator product expansion to compute it. What we usually first do is we divide this set of operators into two groups. I will call this group here the bottom, and this group here the top. Then what we do, we usually first have to choose what is called a conformal frame. These are two points, say one here, let it be zero, and one here, let it be infinity. And then we act with all the conformal generators that leaves these two points invariant, that leave a conformal frame invariant, only on the bottom part, making them approach this point. In that limit, so all the points here are approaching this point, we expand this four-point function in that case in all the states in the theory that propagate from this bottom group to the top group. And these states are parameterized by what? By their quantum numbers under these conformal transformations that leaves our conformal frame invariant. This will be the dimension, the eigenvalue of the dilatation operator that took points from 0 to infinity. And if we are in a four dimension, it will be the spin. This will be an S3. So the four-point function of such four local operator, let's say O1 at x, O2 at 0, O3 at 1, and O4 at infinity. And therefore, as an expansion of the form, sum over all the states in the theory, some coefficient, let me call C, delta, and L, and how much you have to propagate to go from here to here, 1 over, that case, x to the power 2 delta. This can be written as a sum of the three-point function, so let me call it a different name, C1 to P, CP3, 4, times the conformal block for this operator P that, of course, depends on 1, 2, 3, 4, and the conformal cross ratio, x. What we will do for this object here is exactly the same. We will even have this notion of resumming that in conformal blocks. So instead of now going and describing the general case, let's consider the most simple example. So the simple example I want to discuss is the octagon in R11 kinematics. So we will restrict all these points now to live in a plane. So in a plane, if you have a null polygon, all you can do, let's suppose this would have been x plus in this plane, and this would have been x minus, all you can do is go in the x plus direction, then go in the x minus direction, in the x plus direction, and so on. So this, for example, would be k1, k2, and so on. Now, if we are in this restricted kinematics, the conformal cross ratios factorize into conformal cross ratios in the x plus direction and conformal cross ratios in the x minus direction. And therefore, in order to have some conformal cross ratio, we must have at least 4 points in the x plus direction and 4 points in the x minus direction. So this is why the octagon is the simplest example where we have some cross ratios. So let me draw an octagon. Maybe I'll draw it here. So I'll replace this picture by an octagon. So here is an octagon. It has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 edges. And let this direction be the x plus direction, and this direction be the x minus direction. Okay? Now we can use the, as we did for the four-point function here, we can use conformal symmetry to set 3 points in the x plus direction and 3 points in the x minus direction. Let's set this point to be 0, set this point to be at 1, this point to be at infinity, but this point is what we will call e to the tau. Let me do the same thing in the x minus direction. We call this point to be 0, this is 1, this is infinity, and this point I will call e to the sigma. Let me call it e minus tau. This is e to the minus sigma. What we will now do, we will take the limit where tau goes to infinity. You see, in the limit where tau goes to infinity, what is happening is that this edge will go down and be squashed with the edge downstairs. Okay? In this limit, we have an expansion of some excitations that propagate from what we will call here the bottom to the top. So what is this tau direction? This is some family of polygon that you see that edges send tau to 0. This edge coincides with the bottom edge. And as we set tau to infinity, we go to infinity here. So the analog of our conformal frame is these two lines, the one at 0 and the one at infinity. So the analog of, say, conformal frame, we now what we'll call the reference square. The reference square is the square that is made from this bottom edge here at 0, this bottom edge here at infinity, and these two null lines. And the claim is that the expectation value of this octagon, let's call it R8, in this limit has the following expansion. We have here the sigma direction, just in the same way where we have here angular momentum. So we'll have we will parameterize the state by the momentum in this direction. So I'll do a Fourier transform, dP into the I, P sigma. Then we have to sum over all the excitations in the theory. We call it sum over all delta. There's some coefficient, C of delta, of P, which is the probability to emit this excitation here and absorb it back in the top. It's the same as this OPE coefficients, so like the probability of emitting some state in the bottom and absorbing it in the top. And then we'll have the propagation of this excitation along the reference square, e to the minus delta of P times tau. Okay. Most of this talk I will talk about weak coupling, but let's take a glance to the result for the expectation value of this octagon Wilson loop at strong coupling and see that it follows this structure. So at strong coupling, this RA is equal to the following integral, integral d theta over sine hyperbolic of 2 theta time L2 minus e to the minus, this is the important piece, 2 tau cosine hyperbolic of theta plus I times 2 sigma times the sine hyperbolic, I hope you can see, of theta. So in the limit where tau goes to infinity, I can remove this li 2. So this goes to the same integral, but now just with this factor again, e to the minus 2 tau cosine hyperbolic of theta plus 2i sigma times sine hyperbolic of theta. What we see is just the propagation of a particle whose momentum is the coefficient of sigma here. So p equal to 2 sine hyperbolic of theta, where its energy is equal to the coefficient of tau, which is 2 cosine hyperbolic of theta, which I can also write the square root of 4 plus p squared. So what we see here is a propagation of a particle with a relativistic dispersion relation and a mass 2. This is indeed what we see when we study the excitations around this solution at strong coupling. Now, let's now go to weak coupling and see the same thing. So at weak coupling, what I want to compute the remainder function for this octagon at weak coupling. The remainder function, by definition, only starts at two loops. However, we want to have already some non-zero expression for this octagon at one loop. So let's consider the following diagrams. Consider all the diagrams that contributes to the correlation function between this piece here and this piece here. It's like the difference between the reference square and our polygon on the bottom, and the difference between our reference square and the polygon on the top. And all these diagrams are all diagrams of the form that start on the edge here and end on the edge here. I will call this quantity small r. And for this octagon, this is a one loop result, so it's go like g squared. It's equal to log of 1 plus e to the minus tau times the log of 1 plus e to the minus 2 sigma. Basically, when you do this propagator, you have factorization of the integral along this edge and the integral along this edge. Each one gives its log, and you get the product of these two logs. Okay? Let's now expand this result at large tau. It's just equal to g squared over 2 integral dp e to the I p sigma. Then we have just the expansion of this log, sum over k minus 1 to the k over k. We have some c, which is just the Fourier transform of this other log. Let me even not mention what it is. C of p times e to the minus 2 k tau. Well, again, we see a sum of propagation of particles. All of them has very classical dimension, which is integer. Note that this piece here is nothing but the conformal block of a primary of dimension 1, SL2 primary. So this is a conformal block. What we did here in more generality is the small r is the following ratio of polygons. The small r is just equal to the log of the following ratio of polygons, our original polygons, let me draw it like that, times the reference square divided by a polygon that is made from the top, made of the reference square, but the bottom kept the same as our original polygons, times the same when you put the top of the polygon. Note that this ratio is designed such exactly that all the UV divergences cancel out. If you are computing the dual conformal anomaly that we heard from Hand last week, we find that it's exactly cancel. Every cusp that is here, there is something here to cancel it down. So this is a very good observable. It's automatically finite at any loop order, and we should study it directly. Note that the difference between this observable and the reminder function is very simple. It's only a result of lower n amplitudes. Suppose we, so this R is also equal to the reminder function minus the same R computed in the U1 theory. Okay? The reminder function is defined to be the exponent of the one loop result dressed by the cusp anomalous dimension. Let me call it R U1 theory. The point is that this is very easy to compute. It's just we compute it in the U1 theory and dress it by the cusp anomalous dimension. Minus the same thing with the lower n amplitude. In particular, this quantity that we have defined here share this channel with the full reminder function, because all the thing that we subtract here don't have anything that propagates here, or have just a trivial U1 piece that propagates here. And what would we do in more general? More general, when we have such a Wilson loop, let me draw it again here. We have to identify first two null lines of these polygons. These two null lines will define for us the channel of the OP that we are interested in. After defining this two null line, we'll have to close them, as we did for the octagon, into some reference square. Then we will split the edges into the edges that are here on the bottom and the edges that are here on the top. And it will act with these generators of the conformal group that leave the reference square invariant on the bottom part, squeeze them down to the reference square. And again, we have expansion of all excitations propagating. So this will in general be written again, integral dt into the I p sigma. The only difference now between the general kinematics and this octagon example is that we have two extra directions, two extra transverse directions, and therefore the excitation will not be parameterized by the momenta, but they also have some U1 charge in this extra two dimension, where the reference square is just a point there. So we have again a sum over n, let's call it e to the I m phi, these are the U1 charges, and the rest is the same. The rest have now sum over all particles, some coefficients, C of delta and M of P into the minus delta M of P times tau. This is the, you can even divide it, this is like a single particle exchange. We'll have the same also with two particles, and so on. The reason, maybe let me go back to that, but the reason we can do this separation is that what we have here is this infinite direction, sigma, with some excitation that are gapped. And therefore, we can separate them and talk about one particle, two particles, and so on. But even if this was not true, we can always integrate the related momentum and write it as this form. Let me now discuss, I guess, what you ask yourself, what are these excitations? What are these energies? Where this picture comes about? So, consider a pair of a quark and anti-quark moving in the speed of light. So, right like that. Suppose here we have a quark and here an anti-quark. This quark and anti-quark will form a core of flux going in between them. Maybe a way to draw the same picture that respects more symmetry is the following. R1, 3 is conformally equivalent to R time times S3. So suppose we have here an S3, we can put the quark and anti-quark at the south and the north poles. These quark and anti-quarks now move at the speed of light, so they will be rotating around the equator in the speed of light. And they will form a core of flux that spread along the S3 in between them. The excitations we are studying here are nothing but these ripples of this core of flux. Now, this core of flux in four dimensions, look, is thick. However, in five dimensions, in the dual ADS, it becomes two dimensional. And this is what allows us to have control over it. But note that the only assumption that comes into the validity of this expansion is conformal invariance and the existence of this flux. In other words, that we have a stable vacuum described here by the conformal, by the reference square. So any conformal gauge theory that has a stable core of flux, flux that cannot be screened, will have this expansion. You wonder yourself, here there are two lines, where I describe this as a square. These two lines and the reference square are related by analytic continuation.
What are examples where it doesn't work, the conformal field theory?
You have some quarks or not the center of the gauge group such that the color charge can be screened. So, for n equal to, let me now specify for n equal to 4 Superian meals. And the reason is that for n equal to 4, we really know how to compute this at the planar limit at any value of the cupping. So we will do such an example, and it's very simple. This color flux, or this pair of quark, not a quark, are dual two operators of the following form. These are a trace, let's say z, time d plus, this is derivative in some null direction, to the power s times another z, plus many other ways of permuting the derivative between the two z's. And then in the limit that this s goes to infinity. In the limit that this s goes to infinity, these derivatives completely delocalize the operator along this null direction and creating, you can think about this z and z, these two z's, some two fast particles, and the sea of derivatives between them constitute the flux. And so this is the vacuum where are the excitations. Our operators of the form that in addition to these derivatives, we have some insertions. Our operators of the form trace, see some d plus to some power l, we put here some excitation. Let me put here specific excitation, let me put here f plus minus, and another, all the rest of the derivatives, s minus l, acting on the z plus permutations. In this example that we have here, the sum here is described nothing but the exchange of f plus minus. This is what we need to deform the reference square to become this octagon whistle loop. And all the rest, all this sum over k are the SL2 conformal primaries of this f plus minus. They correspond to these operators of the form d minus to the k minus 1 acting on f plus minus inserted in this trace. This, why do we have these conformal blocks? Why is this excitation organized in such a way? Maybe we would expect that if we have two null lines, each null line comes with an SL2R conformal symmetries, and these are just the conformal block of this SL2R conformal symmetries. However, it happens that at higher loops, this conformal symmetry is spontaneously broken. In particular, at strong coupling, we don't see it. But naively, we would expect it to be there. I can discuss this more later. Let me now discuss how we can use the consistency and of the existence of this flux in order to compute. Let me show how the knowledge for the octagon of this expansion, the validity of it for higher loop, really allow us to go and compute. So here is the result for this small r, for this ratio, at one loop. Just one gluon exchange from the bottom to the top. What would happen when we go from one to two loops? When we go from one to two loops, I'll use this one. There are three things that can, in principle, happen. So now what we do is bootstrapping. We use the existence and consistency of this expansion in order to compute the amplitudes of the Wilson loop. So what correction can we go when we go from one into two, let's say, loops? One correction that can come about is that these form factors, the C's, the probability to emit a particle on the bottom and absorb it on the top, can get a loop correction. If this was the diagram that contributed to this single particle exchange, it can get some loop correction here. So one thing is that this C of P can go to C of P plus loop correction. This will be 0, and this will be 1. Okay. Another correction that starts only two loops is that we can have now a two-particle exchange. We can have now another diagram where another particle go from here to here. We can start to have two particles. And finally, the energy of these particles can get correction due to interaction with the flux. These are like these type of diagrams. So, but at three, this delta, this delta of P, can get the correction. You go to this delta of P zero plus G squared, but I will call gamma of P. Once we plug this type of correction into the exponent there, we can expand in G. So e to the minus the full delta times tau goes into the minus this delta zero plus G squared gamma times tau, which to the order that we are working in is nothing but e to the minus this delta zero times tau times 1 plus g squared tau times gamma. So more generally, this R function a two loop. We then can separate it into two type of curve. You see, this type of curve is really distinct. It goes like it's linear in tau. So that you can write the full thing, the two loops, as a term that is linear in tau, and the piece that is not linear in tau. And you see that the piece that is linear in tau, if this expansion is consistent, would come from correction to the energy of these excitations. So in our follow, we'll focus about how to compute this piece. And we will see that after we compute this piece here in a given channel, by demanding that the result would be consistent with the symmetries, would be the same in any channel that we want, we'll be able to determine uniquely. And this can be done also systematic for any polygon Wilson loops in any kinematics. But let me now show how this works for the octagon. So we'll just concentrate on this type of correction, and we will see how the consistency of this expansion allows it from here to deduct what is the full answer. So let me abuse the board here. So suppose now we are interested in computing this D. This was the term linear in tau in this expansion of the two-loop octagon. It is given by the one-loop result, and we now address that by tau. Of course, g squared that I, now it will be g to the fourth, because you go one loop higher, and the correction, gamma k of p. This is the correction to the energy of this excitation. Remember that we had this SL2 symmetry that allow us to, what I just erased, to sum this excitation into what's called a conformal block. It means that also the anomalous dimension of all the descendants are the same as the anomalous dimension of the primary. In other words, this correction to the energy is independent of K. This can also be shown by demanding that the result will be independent of which exactly reference square we choose to parameterize our family of polygons. Now we see that if this correction is independent of K, we can immediately sum over K. Its dependence didn't change. So this is just equal to g to the 4 tau, and you get back the log that we started with, 1 plus e to the minus 2 tau, times some function of sigma. This function of sigma we can compute exactly using the knowledge of this gamma of p that I'll show you how to compute from integrability. However, we will not need it. I'll show you that just by symmetries we can determine it. So now I want to demand symmetry under channel, changing the channel for the OP expansion, so tau times d. Suppose instead of taking this edge and squashing it here, we take this edge and squash it with that one. In other words, we use cyclicity. The result, cyclicity means that the result should be invariant under tau goes to minus tau. Tau goes to infinity was the limit when this edge become squashed with that edge and not with that one. The result must be invariant under tau being exchanged with minus tau. So imagine, here's the term linear in tau, in the two-loop remainder function. How would be completed to a function that agree with that as tau goes to infinity and is symmetric under tau goes to minus tau? There is a very natural way to do it. We just convert it into log of 1 plus e to the 2 tau times log of 1 plus e to the minus 2 tau times this f of sigma. See, as tau goes to infinity, from this log we get the term linear in tau. The next thing that we can use is parity. The result must be invariant if we change what we call x plus and x minus. So parity tells us that the result must be invariant under exchange of tau and sigma. So what can be the result of this expansion, of this answer if it's invariant under tau goes to sigma? It must be that this f of sigma is exactly of the same form. That is, that the full two-loop remainder function for the octagon is equal to some factor g to the 4 log of 1 plus e to the 2 tau times log of 1 plus e to the minus 2 tau times the same thing with sigma. And this is indeed the two-loop remainder function for the octagon that was obtained before by summing many, many Feynman diagrams and doing some guesswork. After we obtain this result from symmetry, we can go back, Fourier transform it, and read what is this gamma of p. What we find is that this gamma of p is equal to psi of 1 plus I p over 2. Psi is a derivative of log of gamma function. Okay? This psi is just gamma prime over gamma plus the complex conjugate on minus I p over 2 minus 2 psi of 1. This is indeed the anomalous dimension of this excitation. If we insert in this, this is what we call the GKP operators, or the GKP strings, the operators with twist 2 at loud spin, and the energy of F plus minus excitation is exactly that. In a few moments, we will do this computation exactly, and we'll see how to derive that result directly from the integrable spin chain. Okay, so we obtained the two-loop remainder function. What next? Note that a new piece that comes only two loop are two particles. We haven't had to deal with them for getting the two-loop remainder function for this octagon. I think it's crucial to understand the free loops result, because the free loop result will encode the dynamics of two particles and how they interact. And usually in integrable theories, once you understand how two particles interact, you understand how n particles interact, because the interactions are always pairwise. And for this integrable system, we know what are the S matrices, how do they interact at any order in the coupling. So it's very plausible that after we understand the free loop result, we'll be able to give a wise guess to any loop. Note that something special about n equal to 4 here is that it seems to be OP constructible. In other words, to go from the term linear tau to the full term, there is a unique way, assuming that the full result is the full transcendality. Here, transcendality 4. If you assume that this continue, or if you do that for any other polygons, there is a systematic way of how to go from this D to the full thing, just based on this assumption. Based on this assumption, the result is unique. In other words, n equal to 4 seems to be OP constructible, which means that we don't get some additional rational term that we would miss in this way. One more comment, maybe is that not to here we use heavily this SL2 symmetry, or the fact that this anomalous dimension were independent if you're talking about the SL2 primary or the descendants. At higher loop, this symmetry seems to be broken. And the reason it's broken is related to the way we regularize the Wilson loop and define these finite quantities. If one would understand exactly how this symmetry is broken, we'll be able to immediately correct these conformal blocks to higher loops, because we know how the energy of the primary gets corrected. Okay. Just a small comment. I will not discuss, instead of going and discussing how to do more general thing, so we apply the same, and for example, we derive a two-loop hexagon reminder function. And we also apply the same for the heptagon, and we computed this D for the heptagon. The only difference that comes about there is that, or at the race, we have more primaries. Therefore, this original sum include more conformal blocks. But apart from that, it's exactly the same. Let me now instead, since this will probably be talked here next week, let's go to the integrable spin chain that we all probably know and love, and see how to obtain this result, how to compute the energies, the anomalous dimension of excitations along the GKP operators. So, let's do it here. So again, our vacuum now also has this GKP, are the operators of the form trace Z, B plus to the S, and another Z plus the mutation in the limit where S goes to infinity. So this operator has some energy, has some anomalous dimension. What you now want to study is what are the energies of an excitation which is of the form trace Z, B plus to some power L, some excitation, then again, B plus to the S minus L, with another Z, in the limit where S goes to infinity. What to compute is the difference between the energy, the dimension of this operator, and the dimension of this operator. It's a contribution to the energy, or to the twist, due to this, the addition of this excitation. So let me jump to the result, and then we will derive it. So the result is that this energy of P, which is also known as the twist, the dimension minus the spin, is equal to 2 gamma cusp. This is the anomalous the cusp anomalous dimension time log of S plus some irrelevant constant. All this piece is the energy of the vacuum plus the sum of the energies of all the excitations. And these energies of excitations at one loop takes the following form. That is G square of 2 times psi of what I will call small s over 2 plus I p over 2 plus complex conjugate psi small s over 2 minus I p over 2 minus 2 psi of 1. This small s here is what is called the conformal spin. if this was delta minus s, dimension minus spin, this is equal to dimension plus. So for example, for this s plus minus, it doesn't have a spin at all. Therefore, it has conformal dimension 2, and we get back this energy. Let's now start from the Bayesian-Schrödinger beta equations and derive this result. So for simplicity, let me consider the case where this chi excitation is just equal to another z. This is the simplest excitation that we can have, because it's completely captured in what is called the SL2 sector. So from the spin chain language, what are the beta equations? We have as many spin, the constituent of the spin chain, and the beta equation are nothing but the periodicity condition for this change. Meaning that if we take now an excitation and take it all the way around, we get back the same state. So I can write it as 1 is equal to e to the I p times l, the phase shift from taking it around, times the S matrices due to its interactions with all the other spin in the chain. So times the product of all the sites, S of Pi and Pj. Okay. For the SL2 spin chain, this is extremely simple. This is just equal to, let it call it phi of u plus I over 2 over phi of u minus I over 2 times this phi of u I plus over 2 times phi of u minus I over 2 is nothing but this momentum. This phi of u is just equal to u to the power l. In our case, since there are 3 z's, this is just u to the power 3. Times the S matrices, the interaction between all the chains, this is I can write as q of u plus I over q of u minus I. Where this function q of u is equal to the product of all the magnons, all the excitation, part of the momentum, or the rapidity, which is called u, of u minus ui. And this is, of course, a q equal to some uj. Okay. So these are the usual beta equations that describe the SL2 sector, derivatives in some null directions, and z's. However, okay, maybe before that, suppose we solve this equation and find this u's, how do we compute the anomalous dimension? How do we compute the energy? The energy, what we call delta, is equal to sum of this u's to d squared over u squared I plus 1 over 4. Or sum of sine square of the momenta. And with related to the function u, this can also be written as 2i g square times the derivative of log of this q function. Okay? At u equal I over 2 plus complex quantity. So this is the full description of this spin chain at one loop. However, this spin chain is described a different picture from the one that we are interested in. In this spin chain, the vacuum is our disease, where the excitation are the derivatives in the null direction. Luckily, you can do a very simple, what is called particle hole transformation, and translate this equation to describe, again, the same chain, but as an excitation around the vacuum we are interested in, where the vacuum are the derivatives and the excitations are the Z's. Let me describe how to do that. So, again, for us, this phi was just u cubed, because there are only three z's, the two that was there to start with, and the excitation, we want to compute its energy. But excitations, derivative, we have many. So this index here, I, goes from 1 to s. And we want to take the limit where s goes to infinity. It's very, very large. So the same beta equation can also be written in the following form. Let me write it. T of u times q of u equal to this phi at u plus I over 2, q at u plus I, plus phi at u minus I over 2, q u minus I. So these beta equations are nothing but the zeros of the right-hand side. Okay? Any point where this becomes zero, this equation is satisfied. This is nothing but just a polynom in the variable u. Okay? But its degree is s plus 3. It means that in addition to the solution to the original beta equations, we have also three other points where this right-hand side vanishes. These points are called holes. And they will be captured by this function that's then here, t. T of u is equal to phi, I equals from 1 to 3, this extra three zeros of this equation, u minus theta I. These theta I's are the, you want now to change this description to a language where these thetas are the excitations, where the u's are the vacuum. So let's see how to do that. The point is that now as we take s to infinity, here we have a product of a huge number of roots. In the limit that s goes to infinity, they will not scale as s. They will stay roughly finite. So here we have the product of a huge number of roots shifted a bit in the upper plane. So suppose we take now a point u which is a bit in the upper half plane. If we take u that is a bit in the upper plus other half plane, this number here is much, much bigger than this number here, because it's a product of many, many numbers, but each element here is bigger than the one here. So in this limit, we can drop this piece. U is in the upper half plane. What we get is just an effective equation for u, for q, which is q of u plus I over q of u, just the ratio of this guy with this guy, is equal to t over phi. To t of u over this phi of u. But if this is t of u, and phi of u is just u cubed, this equation is trivial to solve. And what we get is that q of u is just equal to some constant times 2 to the u over I times the product of three ratios of gamma function. I equal from 1 to 3, gamma of u minus theta I over 2 over gamma of u plus I over 2 over 2. So nothing but the solution to this equation here. Any term in T gives such ratio of gamma function, and phi just this gives this 2 to the power u over I. I will take the log of this equation, and it's easier to solve in that. Now we can go back and plug this result into the energy. And once we know what is the energy, we can compute. What we find, let me write it here. The following answer. You just plug this equation that we find there into the energy here. We find is that this energy is equal to, again, it's actually written here. So let me complete what is written here. Okay, I'll write again. So this energy, delta, is equal to S plus these two gamma cos times log S plus the constant. Let me explain how to get this piece. This piece comes from the following reason. One can show on general ground that in the limit, just by studying the form of the solution to these equations, at the limit that S goes to zero, that we will always have two holes, two tetas, here out of the three, that are very, very large. They are at plus minus S over square root of 2. I will not describe this now, but this can be shown to hold at any value of the coupling. The contribution of these two large roots is what gives this piece. This is just the dimension of our vacuum, just a trace of the derivatives. In addition, we get this extra root. Apart from the two large roots, we get one that is finite. And for that one, we get these psi functions. Psi of half plus I P over 2 plus psi of half minus I P over 2 minus 2 psi of 1. Just log derivative of gamma function. Now we can easily go and compute higher loop corrections. So the message is that it's very easy to compute these energies at any loop order. It's also very easy to go and read what are the S matrices, how they interact. In other words, we understand this flux tube at any order in the coupling. And therefore, what it seems that it would be crucial to understand if someone could it was just point of data, the free loop octagon. You could analyze it and understand it. You may be able to optimistically guess the all loop result. I can describe the hexagon or higher point, but I think for the first time this is enough. So thank you.
Right in the beginning of non-planar, you wanted to say a few words about that and what's the difference between, like you said, in non-planar case?
I haven't tried to study this, but just note that as long as this flux stays stable, and it does for anything to fall, just by symmetries, this expansion must hold. I haven't tried to plug it.
Anyway, I think we have our marching orders on the octagon.
By the end of this workshop, someone will have to do the derivation on the board.
Yeah, that's right.
just like the three loop.
But the first time you can do it any way you want.
Yeah, by any means necessary.
Right. Maybe one of my collaborators will describe how to derive the octagon, isn't that?
Okay, well, thanks again.